Part 4, Chapter 14. My aunt told everyone I was obeying her vision and would leave the day after tomorrow. When I went next day to the fish mat for the last time, Tissot's mother was waiting to offer me a blanket woven of reed, treated so that the fibers were fuzzy and made a thick, soft texture, warm as wool. "My daughter wove it," Lali Betu said, and I said, "I thank her for it, and will think of you both when the nights are cold." Tissot hung back and didn't try to speak to me. I said goodbye to the women and spoke briefly with my aunt. She didn't want to talk. She wanted me to be gone, to get across the second river and be safe. I left early the next morning before my uncle got up. The puppy was sleeping on his feet. Prut was curled up on my blanket. I whispered, "Go with May," to them all, and slipped out of the little house and away from my village. My heart was heavy in me. I went overland, eastward. My aunt would have disapproved, wanting me to hurry straight to the north. I refused to let her fear drive me. I had no boat, and heading north on foot, I'd have to make a maze of a way through the marshes, endless days of walking. I had no money with me and no means of earning it while I traveled. But it was in my mind that I did have money. Blood money. Guilt money. The payment for my sister's death. I had left it with Kuga, hidden in his cave. It would be enough to take me to Mesun, if I lived light, and I was used to living light. I knew the way that I'd walked with Chamri and Vene. I could keep east of the heart of the forest, so as not to run into Barna's guards when I got that far north. The tricky part would be finding Kuga's cave, south of the Danaran forest. I was sure my gift of memory would guide me when I came among the hills and valleys I had known that summer, if I could find them. I had a backpack stuffed with wayfarer's food, dried smoked fish, hard cheese, hard bread, dried fruit. The women at the fish mat had offered me more food than I could ever use. The men of my village had come to Meter's hut to share with me their little hoards of travel supplies. I had no fear of going hungry for days to come. Besides the food and my new blanket, I carried, as always, my fishing gear, my knife, and the book, wrapped safe in waterproof reed cloth to protect it when I had to ford or swim. I was fit again, able to walk steadily all day and to enjoy it. Within 2 days, I came out of the marshes into a rising, thinly wooded country. I kept bearing east now. As well as I could judge, I wasn't far north of the city of Kasakar. I saw a few farm stands in the distance, desolate-looking places. Cattle and sheep were scattered out in the valleys, not many of them. I passed orchards that had been burned, a ruined farmhouse. Armies had come through here, looting and laying waste, the endlessly warring armies of the city-states. There were no roads, only tracks, and I saw no people but an occasional herdsman or shepherd. We spoke or waved, and I went on. The land continued to rise, and now I was in the hilly, broken, wild country I was looking for. The problem was finding the piece of it I wanted. I had no idea of the direction Kuga's cave lay from where I was now. The woods were thick enough that there was never an overview of the hills. All I could do was go forward, following my nose. As the sun began getting low and golden through the trees that day, I felt myself completely lost, walking at random. My plan was hopeless. I could wander in these hills till I became as weak and crazy as I had been when I first came into them. I sat down to eat a little and put some heart in myself, planning to go on as long as the light lasted before I found a sheltered place to sleep. As I sat down in a little clearing, my back against a young oak, I said with a sigh, O Enu, guide me now. I split a lump of hard bread with my knife, laid a thin slice of smoked fish on it, and ate it slowly, tasting salt and smoke and thinking of my village. I looked up at some movement and saw a black lion come into the clearing about 20 feet from me. It was a lioness, pacing with her head and her long tail low. She stopped and looked straight at me. I said, with no voice, Enu Amba, naming her. She gazed a moment longer and then walked on. She vanished almost at once in the thickets. After a while, I finished my dinner. I wrapped up the fish and put it carefully in my pack. I licked my greasy fingers and wiped them on the deer fern amidst which I sat. My mouth was dry, and I drank from the little bottle of lacquered reed cloth I had refilled at the last stream. I got up slowly. It seemed to me that I had only one way to go. That was to follow the lion. It didn't seem a wise thing to do, but I was in a place where wisdom, maybe, was no use. I followed the lion. Once I was through the thickets, the way she had gone appeared to be a faint path that went through open oak woods, along the top of a long, winding hill, easy walking with fairly good visibility. I didn't see the lion again. I went on steadily for a long time. The sun was striking level through the trees when I recognized where I was. Kuga had led me through this glade, past that enormous ancient oak, when he took me to meet the Forest Brothers. We were in Kugamond, I thought, and then wondered why I had thought we, not I. All I had to do to reach the cave was turn off the lion's road and follow the way I knew, downward and to the right. I stopped and thanked Enu, then turned to the right and went down through the woods I knew with increasing familiarity until I came to the home stream and crossed it and stood before the rock slide that held and concealed the door of the cave. Sunset light was bright on the tops of the trees. I started to say his name, but I knew with absolute certainty that he wasn't there. I said nothing. After a while, I went in through the narrow entrance. My eyes found only darkness in the cave, the smell of smoke and badly cured fur. Kuga's reek, Kuga's stink, was there, but faint, a kind of echo of a smell. It was cold in that darkness. There was no light. I went back outside. The evening seemed marvelously bright and warm, and I remembered the blinding glory of daylight the first time I ever left the cave. I put my pack down by the cave door and took my water bottle to fill it at the stream. I drank and filled the bottle, and squatted there for a while, and as I watched the flow and movement of the water in the gathering twilight, I saw him on the bank of the stream. Animals and the water and weather of a year or 2 years hadn't left very much of him. His skull, with the forehead broken in, and other bones, a couple of scraps of moldy fur clothing, and his leather belt. I touched the skull where it lay, and stroked it a little, talking to Kuga. The light was failing fast, and I was very tired. I didn't want to sleep in the cave. I rolled up in my reed cloth blanket in a grassy bay of the great rock formation, and slept, deep and long. In the morning I went into the cave, thinking to bury him there, but it was so cheerless that it seemed better to let him be where he was. I dug a small grave, high enough above the stream to be out of the winter floods. I gathered his bones into it, and his belt, and one of his knives I found in the cave, and the metal box of salt that had been his greatest treasure. He'd kept it hidden all the time I was with him, and I was never to know where, for I found it lying out on the floor of the fireplace cave. There was a little salt in the bottom of the box. In it also was one of his two prized knives, and the small, heavy bag of money that I had left with him and he had kept for me. It was a relief to my heart to know that he hadn't been killed for the sake of that money. From the fact that he'd taken the things out and not put them away again, I imagined that maybe having been hurt or feeling ill, he'd wanted to look at his treasures. But when he knew he was dying, he left them and went to die outside, in the place he liked to sit beside the stream. I covered the small grave over, smoothing the dirt with my hands, and asked Anu to guide him. I put the bag of money in the bottom of my pack without opening it. I said farewell and set off back up the way that led north and east to the hill where I had first met the Forest Brothers. Ever since I left East Lake, I had felt very lonely. Solitude had always been a pleasure to me, but it had been a rare and relative solitude. Almost always there had been others nearby, in reach. This was different, this aloneness. To have once again walked away from my own people, from all I knew, to know that wherever I went I would always be among strangers, no matter how I tried to tell myself it was freedom, it felt like desolation. That day I left Kugamond was the hardest of all. I plodded on and plodded on, finding the way without thinking about it. When I got to the top of the hill where Kuga had left me, it was time to stop. I stopped. I made no fire, for I didn't want to bring the Forest Brothers or anybody else. I had to go alone, and I would. But I lay there that night and grieved. I grieved for myself and for Kuga. And I grieved for my people in East Lake, Tisso and Gegemer, and my kind, lazy uncle, all of them. And for Chamri Bairn, and Vene, and Diero, and even Barna, for I had loved Barna. And for my people of Arkamond, Sotur, Tib, and Rhys, and little Oko, Astano, Yavin, my teacher Evera, and Sallow. My Sallow. Lost. All of them lost to me. I was heavy with tears I couldn't cry, and my head ached. The great stars of summer slid slowly to the west. I slept at last. I woke with dawn, the sky a transparent pink hill of light over the dark hill of earth. I was hungry and thirsty. I got up and made my pack and went on down the hillside, and at the creek in the hollow, where Brigand had not let me drink my fill, I drank my fill. I was alone, so then I'd go alone and live my life as I saw fit. I'd drink where I wanted to drink. I'd go to Mesun, where all men were free men, and where the university taught wisdom and the poet Caspro lived. I tried to sing his hymn to liberty as I strode along, but I never could sing, and my voice in the silence and birdsong of the woods sounded like a young crow squawking. Instead, I let the words of his poem come into my head and come with me on my way, making a quieter music to keep me company. Things change fast in a forest. Trees fall. Young trees shoot up. Brambles grow across the path, but the way was always clear enough when I looked for it and let my memory tell me where I'd gone. I came to the clearing, where we'd picked up the venison, and ate my midday dinner there. I wished I had some of that venison. My pack was getting all too light. I wondered if I should begin to veer eastward again, to come out of the Danaran Forest and try my luck at buying food in a village or a town. But I didn't want to do that yet. I'd stay in the forest, making a wide pass around Brigand's camp, if it was still there, taking the way Chamri had taken us till I got to a safe distance from Barna's city. Then I'd head northeast to find one of the villages outside the forest, on the Somulane, the first of the two great rivers I was to cross. My plan went well, until I was more or less east of Barna's city, following the Somulane as it took a northerly bend through the forested hills. I was pretty hungry, and there were backwaters of the river in which I could see trout swimming as plain as pigeons flying in the sky. It was too much for me. I stopped at a lovely pool, put my rod together, baited my hook with a caddisfly, and caught a good fish in no time, and a second one in not much more than no time. I was just casting my line again when somebody said, "Gav?" I jumped, lost my bait, grabbed for my knife, and stared at the man who stood behind me. For a moment, I didn't know him. Then I recognized Ater, one of the raiders who had caught Irad and Mela. They'd told the story in the beer house. He'd said he liked his women soft. A big, heavy man he had been then, but he was a big, gaunt man now. I stared at him in terror, but there was no threat in his gaze. He looked dully surprised. "How'd you get here, Gav?" he said. "I thought you drowned or went off. Before." "Went off," I said.
"You coming back then?"
I shook my head.
"Nothing much to come back to," he said.
He looked at my two fish. I knew how hunger looks at food. "What do you mean, Ater?" I said when I began to realize what he'd said. He turned his hands out in a helpless gesture.
"Well," he said, "you know."
I stared at him. He stared at me.
"It's all burned down," he said.
"The city? The heart of the forest? Burned down?" It was hard for him to understand that I didn't know about the event that loomed so immense in his life. It took me a while to get much sense out of him. My first concern was that other men would be following him, that Barna's guards would be on me, take me captive, but he just kept saying,
"No, nobody's coming. They're all gone. Nobody's coming," he said. "I came over to that village we used to go to see if there was some food there. But they burned it too."
"Who?"
"The soldiers."
"Kesikar?"
"I guess so."
Getting information out of him was going to be a slow business. I said, "Is it safe to make a fire?" He nodded. "Make one then, and put the fish on a stick and toast them. I've got a little bread here." I succeeded in landing another big trout while he made the fire. He could hardly wait to char the fish over the fire. He ate with desperate haste, cramming the hard bread into his mouth and chewing it painfully.
"Ah," he said, "ah, that's good. Thanks, Gav. Thanks."
I went back to fishing after we ate. When the trout jump at an empty hook, it's a sin not to let them do it. While I fished, he sat on the bank and told me what had happened to the heart of the forest. Much of the story I had to guess from his incoherent telling. Etra and Kesikar were allies now, in a northern league against Votis, Morva, and smaller cities south of the moor. A lot of farm slaves had been killed during the wars between Etra and Kesikar, or had run away, and had to be replaced or recaptured. Towns all round the Danaran Forest had long been full of rumors of the great camp or city of runaway slaves, and the new allies decided to go in and find out what was there. They sent an army, a legion from each city, on a rapid march up between Danaran and the marshes. Barna's people knew nothing about the attack until outpost guards came running into the city, shouting the warning. Barna gathered all the men who could stand with him to defend the heart of the forest.
He ordered the women and children to scatter out in the woods. Many of the men ran with them. Any who hesitated or stayed to fight were soon trapped. The soldiers surrounded the walls and methodically set them afire, and then the whole city, hurling torches onto the roofs of the wooden buildings. Barna's men made a sortie against them, but were outnumbered, cut down, slaughtered. The soldiers ringed the burning town and caught all who fled the Holocaust, then ranged out and rounded up people hiding or trying to escape in the woods. They spent a couple of nights waiting till the fires burnt out so they could loot what was left. They found the treasury and divided that. They divided the prisoners, half for Etra, half for Kasikar, and then marched back, driving the chained slaves along with the cattle and sheep. There were tears on Ater's cheeks as he told me the story, but his voice remained dull and even. He'd been out with a raiding party when they saw the smoke of the burning city from miles away in the north. They had crept back a couple of days after the soldiers left. "Barna," I said, and Ater said, "They said the soldiers cut off his head and kicked it around like a ball." It was very hard to ask about any of the others. When I did, Ater had no answers. Often he seemed not even to know who I was talking about. Chamri? He shrugged. Vene? He didn't know. Diero? He didn't know. But evidently a number of people had escaped one way or another, and many of them had regathered in the ruined city, not knowing where else to go. Some of the grain supplies had remained hidden and untouched, and they'd lived off them and what was left of the gardens. For how long? Again, Ater was vague. I guessed that the raid and fire had been about half a year ago, perhaps in early winter. "You're going back there now?" I asked him, and he nodded. "It's safer there," he said. "The soldiers been raiding everywhere, taking slaves. I was at Ebera, over there, near as bad off as we are. No slaves left to work the fields." "I'll come with you," I said. I had to know what had become of my friends. I'd caught 5 more good-sized fish. I packed them up in leaves and we set off. We came to the heart of the forest in the late afternoon. The city I had last seen silver-blue in moonlight was a waste of charred beams, shapeless mounds, ash fields. At one edge, near the gardens, people had made huts and shelters with salvaged lumber, much of it half-burned. An old woman was weeding in the garden, bowed back, averted face. A couple of men sat in the doorways of their huts, their hands hanging between their knees. A dog barked at us, then whined and cowered away. A child sat on the dirt, gazing listlessly at Ater and me. As we came near, it too cowered away from us. I had come in order to ask about my friends, but I couldn't ask. I could only see Diero trapped in Barna's house as it burned, Chamri's corpse dumped in a common grave, Vene driven down the road in chains. I said to Ater, "I can't stay here." I gave him the packet of fish. "Share it with somebody," I said. "Where are you going then?" he asked in his blank way.
"North."
"Look out for slave takers," Ater said. I was about to turn back the way we'd come, when something grabbed both my legs so hard and suddenly that I nearly lost my balance. It was a child. The child who'd stared and shrunk from us.
"Beaky, Beaky, Beaky," she cried in a high, thin voice, like a bird. "Oh, Beaky, oh, Beaky."
I had to pry her hands loose from my legs, and then she gripped my hands with sparrow claw fingers, looking up into my face,
her face all dust and bone and tears.
Millie?
She pulled me to her. I picked her up. She weighed nothing. It was like picking up a ghost. She clung to me tightly, just as she used to when I came to Diero's room to teach her letters. She hid her face against my shoulder. Where does she live? I asked Ater, who had stopped to stare at us. He pointed to a hut nearby. I started to carry her towards it.
Don't go there, she whispered. Don't go there.
Where do you live then, Mella?
Nowhere.
A man looked from the doorway of the hut that Ater had pointed out. I'd seen him working as a carpenter, but had never known his name. He too had the dull look, the siege face. Where's the girl's sister? I asked him. He shrugged. Diero didn't escape, did she? The man shrugged again, this time with a grinning sneer at the question. Gradually, his look sharpened. He said,
"You want that one?"
I stared at him.
"Half a bronze for the night," he said, "or food, if you've got any."
He stepped forward, trying to get a look at my backpack. I went through a quick, complex set of thoughts. I said, "What I have, I keep," and set straight off, walking back the way I'd come. Mille clung to my neck, silent, her face hidden. The man shouted after me, and the dog, barking, set off other dogs in a chorus of barks and howls. I drew my knife, glancing back constantly, but nobody followed us. When I'd walked a half mile or so, I knew that my little ghost was a great deal more solid than I'd thought, and also that I'd better think what I was doing. Coming across the faint trace of a path, I went along it for some way, then turned aside. Behind a thicket of elderberries that screened us from the path, I set Mella down on her feet and sat down next to her to get my breath. She squatted down beside me.
"Thank you for taking me away," she said in a thread of a voice.
She would be 7 or 8 years old now, I thought. She hadn't grown very much, and was so thin her joints looked like knobs. I got some dried fruit out of my pack and offered it to her. She ate it, with a pitiful and terrible attempt not to be greedy. She held out a piece to me. I shook my head. "I ate a little while ago," I said. She devoured the fruit. I cut a piece of my rock-hard bread into little morsels and warned her to suck them to soften them before she chewed. She sat with the bread in her mouth, and her dirty, bony face began to relax. "Mille," I said, "I'm going north, away, to a city called Mesun."
"Please, can I come with you?"
she whispered, her face tightening again, her eyes getting big, only daring one glance up at me. "You don't want to stay there at—"
"Oh, no, please, no."
The same whisper.
"Please, no."
"There's nobody there who—" She shook her head again and again.
"No, no, no,"
she whispered. I didn't know what to do. That is, there was only one thing I could do, but I didn't know how I was going to manage it. "Are you pretty good at walking?"
"I can walk and walk," she said earnestly.
She put another little lump of bread in her mouth, timidly, and sucked it as I had told her to do. "Well," I said, "you'll have to."
"I will, I will. You won't have to carry me, I promise."
"That's good. We ought to walk on away now, because I want to get back to the river before dark. And tomorrow, we'll leave the forest, all right?"
"Yes,"
she said, and her eyes shone. She stood right up. She walked along bravely, but her legs were short, and she didn't have much strength in her little starved body.
Fortunately, we reached the Somulane again sooner than I expected, coming down an open glade to a long bend in the river. The fishing there wasn't like the wonderful pool farther upstream, but I did catch a trout and a couple of perch, enough for our supper. The grass was soft, and the light fell sweetly through the trees across the water, turning it to bronze.
"It's pretty here," Mille said.
She fell asleep as soon as she had eaten. She lay in a little heap on the grass. My heart turned over at the sight of her fragility. How could I take this child with me? But how could I not take her? Luck hears prayers only with his deaf ear, but I spoke to him, to the ear that hears the wheels of the chariots of the stars. I said, "You used to be with me, Lord, when I didn't know it. I hope you're with this child now, and not just fooling her." And I spoke in silence also to Enu, thanking her and asking her to guide us. Then there was nothing to do but roll Mille up with me in my soft reed cloth blanket and sleep. We both woke as dawn was brightening. Mille went off by herself to the riverside, and when she came back, she had managed to wash herself quite clean and was shivering with wet and cold. I wrapped the blanket round her again while we ate a little breakfast. She was shy and solemn. "Mille," I said, "your sister?" She said in a strange, small, even voice, "We tried to hide. Back of the sheep pastures. The soldiers found us. They took Irad away. I don't remember." I remembered Barna's raider telling how they had taken the two girls from the village, how Ater had been going to toss the little one aside, but they clung too tight together. They hadn't been able to hold on to each other this time. Mille's chin trembled. She looked down and chewed on her bit of hard bread but couldn't swallow. Neither of us could say anything more about Irad. After a long time, I said, "Your village was over on the west side of the forest. Do you want to go back there?"
"To the village?"
She looked up and thought hard.
"I can't remember it much," she said.
"But you had family there. Your mother." She shook her head.
"We didn't have any mother. We belonged to Gonbuli. He hit us a lot. My sister..."
She didn't finish. Maybe Luck had been with Mille after all, but never with Irad. "All right, then you'll come with me," I said in as matter-of-fact tone as I could manage. "But listen, we'll be going on the roads, into villages, some of the time at least. Among people, I think it might be better if you were my little brother. Can you pretend to be a boy?"
"Of course," she said, interested in the idea.
She thought about it.
"I need a name. I can be Miv."
I almost said no, but stopped myself. She should have the name she chose herself. Like Mille, it was a common name. "All right. Miv," I said with a little effort. "And I'm Avi."
"Avi," she repeated, and then murmured, "Avi Beaky,"
with a tiny smile. "And who we are is this. We aren't slaves, because there aren't any slaves in Urdile, where we live. I'm a student at the university in Mesun. I study with a great man there who's waiting for us. I'm taking you there to be a student, too. We come from just east of the marshes." She nodded. It all seemed perfectly convincing to her. But she was 8 years old. "What I hope is, we can mostly keep off the big roads and just go through the countryside. I have some money. We can buy food in villages and from farmers. But we have to look out for slave takers. Everywhere. If we don't meet any of them... we'll be all right."
"What is the great man in Mesun's name?"
she asked. A good question. I hadn't prepared for it. Finally, I said the only name of a great man in Mesun I knew.
"Orek Caspro."
She nodded.
There seemed to be one more thing on her mind. She finally said, "I can't pee like a boy,"
she said. "That's all right, don't worry. I'll stay on guard." She nodded. We were ready to go. A short way downstream from the bend of the river, it widened and shoaled out, and I said, "Let's cross here."
"Can you swim, Miv?"
"No.
If it gets too deep, I can carry you."
We took off our shoes and tied them to my pack. I fastened a length of light rope around Mela's waist and my own, with a few feet of slack between us. We waded out into the river hand in hand. I thought of my vision of crossing a river, and wondered if soon I'd be carrying the child on my shoulders, which were still sore from carrying her yesterday. But this didn't look at all like the river I remembered. By picking a zigzag way on the high point of the shoals, I was never more than waist deep, and could hold Mela up well enough, except in one place where the current ran fast and deep alongside an islet of gravel. There, I told her to hold tight to the rope around my waist and keep her head up the best she could, and I waded in, swam the few yards to the gravel bar, and wallowed ashore. Mela went under only at the last moment, when she thought she could touch bottom and couldn't. She came up, choking and sputtering. After that, we had only shallow waters to wade, and soon came to the far shore. As we sat getting our breath, drying out, and putting on our shoes, I said, "We've crossed the first of the two great rivers we have to cross. This is the land of Bendele."
"The hero Hamneda had to swim across a river when he was wounded, didn't he?"
I can't say how much that touched me. It wasn't that she'd learned the story of Hamneda from me. It was that she thought of him, that he was familiar to her mind and heart as he was to mine. We had a common language, this child and I, a language I hadn't spoken with anyone else since I left my own childhood in Etra. I put my arm around her little thin shoulders, and she wriggled against me comfortably. "Let's go find a village and buy some food," I said. "Hold on, though. Let me get some money out so I don't wave all of it in people's faces." I dug into my pack and brought out the heavy little silk pouch. A faint, smoky kuga reek still clung to it. Or maybe it had just been close to the smoked fish from Ferusi. I untied the cord, opened the pouch, and stared. I remembered what it had held. Bronzes and 4 silver pieces. But along with the bronzes, there were now 9 silver pieces, 4 of the gold pieces from Pagadi called Dictators, and a broad gold coin from Ansul. My kuga had been a thief as well as a runaway. "I can't carry this," I said. I looked at the money with horror. All I saw was the danger it posed us if anyone should get the slightest notion that we carried such a fortune. It was in my mind to simply dump the gold pieces out in the grass and gravel and leave them. "Did somebody give it to you?" I nodded, speechless.
"You can sew up money and clothes to hide it," Mela said, handling the dictators with admiring curiosity. "These are pretty, but the big one is the prettiest. Have you got a needle and thread?"
"Only fish hooks and fishing line."
"Well, maybe I can get some sewing things in a village. Maybe there'll be a peddler on the road. I can sew."
"So can I," I said stupidly. "Well, all I can do now is put it back. I wish I hadn't found it."
"Is it a lot of money?"
I nodded. She was still studying the coins.
"See? I, city of P-A-C something,
Pagadi," I said.
"Oh, the words go all the way round.
State and City of Pagadi, Year 8 something.
Her head was bent over the coin, just as it had used to bend over her reading in Barna's house, in the lamplight in Diero's room. She looked up and smiled at me as she handed it back. Her eyes were luminous. I kept out a few quarter and half bronzes and hid the pouch away again. We walked on up along the river, for there was a clear path. After we had gone for an hour or more, Mila said,
"Maybe when we get to the city, where we're going, we can find out where my sister is and buy her from the soldiers with the gold."
"Maybe we can," I said, my heart twisting again. Presently, I added in my anxiety, "But we can't talk about it. At all."
"I won't," she said.
She never did. Following the river as it took a sharp turn north, we came that afternoon to a fair-sized town. I summoned up my courage to enter it. Mila seemed quite fearless, trusting in my strength and wisdom. We walked boldly into the marketplace and bought ourselves food. I bought a blanket for Mila, which she could also wear as a poncho, and haggled for a little case containing a stout needle and a hank of linen thread. People wanted to talk with us, asking us where we were from and where we were bound. I told my story, and student of the university was mysterious enough to most people that they didn't know what further questions to ask. The plump, snaggle-toothed woman who was demanding a quarter bronze for the thread and needle looked at Mila with compassion and said, "I can see it must be a terrible hard life for a little fellow, studenting." "He was sick all last winter," I said.
"Was he then? What's your name, sonny boy?"
"Miv," Mila said calmly.
"I'm sure your brother takes good care of you and doesn't let you walk too far,"
the woman said. And perhaps because she'd seen that I wasn't going to pay such a price as she asked, or for a better reason, she went on,
"And this is for you, to keep you safe on your journey, a gift. A gift. I wouldn't ask money of a child for the blessing of Enu."
She held out a little figure of a cat, carved of dark wood, with a copper wire round its neck to hang it from as a pendant. There were several such little enumes on her tray. Mila looked up at me with big eyes. I remembered she and Irad had worn such figures on a necklace, though these were finer than what they'd had. I handed the woman her extortionate price and nodded to Mila to take the carving. She clutched it in her hand and held her hand tight to the base of her throat. I felt unexpectedly easy and safe in the marketplace. We were strangers among strangers, lost in a crowd, not isolated, solitary travelers in a wilderness. A booth was selling some kind of sweet fried cake that smelled delicious. "Let's have some of that," I said to Mela, and when we each had a hot cake in hand, we sat down on the broad edge of a fountain in the shade to eat them. They were greasy and heavy, and Mila got through only about half of hers. I looked at her sidelong, seeing what the snaggle-toothed woman had seen, that this was a very thin little child who looked on the point of exhaustion. "Are you tired, Miv?" I said. After a slight struggle with herself, she hunched her shoulders and nodded. "Let's stay at an inn. We won't often get a chance to, I expect." "This is a nice town," I said recklessly. "You got cold crossing the river. You walked a long way today. You deserve a real bed tonight." She hunched up some more and looked down at her greasy cake. She showed it to me.
"Can you eat it, Beaky?" she whispered.
"I can eat anything, Squeaky," I said, proving it. "Now come on. There was an inn back there just off the market square." The innkeeper's wife took an interest in Mila. Evidently my companion was a passport to people's sympathy. We were given a nice little room at the back of the house,
with a wide, short bed. Mille climbed up on the bed at once and curled up. She still held her enume tight in her hand. She was wearing her new poncho and didn't want to take it off. "It keeps me warm," she said, but I saw she was shivering. I covered her over, and she fell asleep soon. I sat in the chair by the window. It was a long time since I'd sat in a chair, since I'd been in a great, solid house like this, very different from the huts and the marshes and their walls of reed. I took my book out and read for a while. I knew the cosmologies pretty well by heart, but just holding the book, letting my eyes follow the printed lines, was reassuring to me. I needed reassurance. I had no real idea what I was doing or where I was going, and now I'd taken on a charge who at best would slow me down very much. Maybe I could leave her in this town with somebody, I thought, and come back for her later. Leave her? Come back from where? I looked over at her. She was sound asleep. I went out quietly to see about dinner. I brought her back a bowl of chicken broth, and she roused up to drink it, but drank very little. She was feverish, I thought. I consulted with the innkeeper's wife, Ameno, who had the hearty, jolly manner of her trade, but underneath it seemed a quiet, serious woman. She came and looked at Mella and said she might have caught something or might just be very tired. She said, "Go on and have your supper. I'll keep the fire up and look in at the child." She had persuaded Mella to let her have the little cat figure so she could put it on a necklace. Mella was watching her braid thread for the necklace and dozing off again. I went to the common room and had an excellent supper of roast mutton, which made me think with affection and pain of Chamri Baron. We stayed at the inn in Rami 4 nights. It didn't take Ameno long to let me know she knew Mele wasn't a boy, but she asked no questions. It was clear enough why a girl might want to travel as a boy, and dropped no hints to anyone else. Mele wasn't sick, but she'd been pretty near giving out. 3 days of rest and good food and kind care did wonders for her. She sat in bed and carefully sewed our gold pieces into our clothing, and then slept again. I would have stayed on still longer to build her up for travel if it hadn't been for what I heard the 4th night at the inn. Men of the town came in every evening for a glass of beer or cider and to chat with one another and with any guests at the inn who wanted to be sociable. They were a bit cautious and stiff with me at first, because I was supposed to be a scholar and a city man. But seeing that I wasn't much more than a boy and spoke little and modestly, they soon ignored me in a friendly fashion. They talked about local affairs, of course, but the travelers among them made conversation about the wider world, too, which was interesting to me, who had been for so long in the forest and the marshes, hearing nothing of the city-states and Bendeley. Mele was sleeping sound after a good supper, and I came to sit at the common room fire. Conversation had fallen on the Barnavites. Everybody had a story about Barna's men, who used to raid the roads and farms and market towns. Some were the old romantic tales I'd heard in Etra. But one man here confirmed them. He said that 3 years ago, raiders had taken half the flock he was driving to market, but they'd truly taken half his flock, counting them out, one for you, one for us, when they could as well have taken them all. And so, he said, he could only curse them with half a curse. I had the impression that his hearers half believed him, too. Then they all had tales about Barna's city, how the slaves kept houses full of beautiful women, how they had so much stolen gold there that they used it for roofing, and when the soldiers burned the city, molten gold ran in streams in the gutters. Everybody knew about Barna, the giant with flaming red hair, taller than any other man, who'd planned to attack Ascion, make himself king of Bendeley, and put the slaves to rule their fallen masters.
There was some discussion of the fact that you never could trust a slave, no matter how loyal he seemed, and several examples of slavish treachery were given.
"Well, here's a tale for you," said one of the guests of the inn, a wool buyer from Eastern Bendeley, "about a disloyal slave and a loyal one, too. I just heard this one. There was a slave boy from the marshes who'd been the pride of his masters in the city of Etra. He could tell any tale or sing any song, no matter what. He knew them all. He was worth 100 gold pieces to his masters. He defiled a daughter of the house and ran away, stealing a bag of gold with him. They set out slave takers after him, but none found him, and some said he'd drowned. But the son of the house had a royal slave who swore he'd find the boy and bring him back to Etra to take his punishment for shaming the house of his masters. So he got on the track, and after a while he heard word of a young runaway in Barna's city, who was famous for his speaking and singing. Barna himself, having been a learned slave, set a great value on this boy. But before the soldiers came, the boy gave Barna the slip too, and vanished again. The slave is still hunting for him. I talked to a man who knows him. He calls him Three Eyebrows. He's been to the marshes, and to Kasikar, and Piram, and says he'll hunt the runaway down if it takes him the rest of his life. Now there's a slave loyal to his masters, I say."
The others expressed modified approval. I tried to imitate their judicious nods, while the heart in me was cold as a lump of ice. My pose of being a scholar, which I hoped would save me from suspicion, now looked likely to bring it upon me. If only the man hadn't said the runaway was from the marshes. My looks, the color of my skin, always drew some notice anywhere outside the marshes, and sure enough, a townsman eyed me over his beer and said,
"You look to be from that side of the country. Do you know anything about this famous slave, then?"
I couldn't speak. I shook my head with as much indifference as I could pretend. More stories of escapes and slave takers followed. I sat through them, drank my cider, and told myself that I must not panic, that nobody had questioned my story, that having the child with me would avert suspicion. Tomorrow we'd set off again. It had been a mistake to stay anywhere for any length of time. But then Mela could never have gone on if we hadn't rested here. It would be all right. We would come to the second river in only a few days, and cross it, and be free. I spoke with Ameno that night, asking if she knew of any carters going north that might give us a lift. She told me where to go. Early in the morning, I routed sleepy Mela out. Ameno sent us off with a pack of food and took the silver piece I offered her. "Luck be with you. Go with Enu," she said, and gave Mela a long, grave embrace. We went off through the foggy dawn, to a yard on the far edge of town where carters met to make up their loads, and sometimes find passengers. And there we found a ride as far as a place called Tertudi, which the carter said was halfway to the river. I had no clear map of this part of Bendeley in my mind, and had to rely on what people told me, knowing only that the river was north of us, and Mesun across it, and well to the east. It took our carter's slow horses all day to get to Tertudi, a small, poor town with no inn. I didn't want to stay there and be noticed. I hoped to break any connection with the inn at Rami, to leave no traceable path behind us. We spoke to no one in Tertudi, but simply walked away from it for a couple of miles into the hayfields that surrounded it, and made ourselves a camp by a little stream for the night. Crickets sang all about us in the warm evening, near and far. Mela ate with a good appetite and said she wasn't tired. She wanted me to tell her a story she knew. That was her request. "Tell me a story I know."
I told her the beginning of the Chamhan. She listened, intent, never moving, till at last she began to blink and yawn. She fell asleep curled up in her poncho, holding the little cat figure at the base of her throat. I lay listening to the crickets and looking out for the first stars. I slipped into sleep peacefully, but woke in the dark. There was a man in the hayfield, standing watching us. I knew him. I knew his face, the scar that split his eyebrow. I tried to get up, but I was paralyzed, as I had been paralyzed by Dorad's drugs. I couldn't move, and my heart pounded and pounded. It was deep night, the stars blazing. Most of the crickets had fallen silent, but one still trilled nearby. No one was there. But I could not sleep again. It grieved me that blind hate and rancor should be my last link to Archimonde. I could think now of the people of that house with gratitude for what they had given me, kindness, security, learning, love. I could never think that Sotur or Yavin had or would have betrayed my love. I was able to see, in part at least, why the mother and father had betrayed my trust. The master lives in the same trap as the slave, and may find it even harder to see beyond it. But Torm and his slave double, Hobi, never wanted to look beyond it. They valued nothing but power, the most brutal control of other people. My escape, if he heard of it, would have rankled Torm bitterly. As for Hobi, always seething with envious hatred, the knowledge that I was going about as a free man would goad him to rageful, vengeful pursuit. I had no doubt that he was on my trail, and I was deeply afraid of him. By myself, I was no match for him, and now I had my little helpless hostage with me. She would awaken all his cruelty. I knew that cruelty. I roused Mela well before dawn, and we set off. All I knew to do was walk, walk on, get away. We walked all day through rolling, open country. We passed a couple of villages at a distance and avoided the few farms with their barking dogs. Mostly it was grazing land, cattle scattered out across the grasslands. We met up with a cowboy who waited for us and walked his horse along with us to talk. Mela was afraid of him, shrinking away from him, and I was none too glad of his company. But he had no curiosity about where we came from or where we were going. He was lonesome and wanted somebody to talk to. He got off his horse and rambled along with us, talking all the way about his horse and his cattle and his masters and whatever came into his head. Mela gradually seemed to feel easier. When he offered her a ride, she shrank away again, but she was much attracted by the friendly little horse, and finally, she let me put her up in the saddle. Our new friend had told us he was out to round up some of his master's cattle, which had strayed from the main herd, but he seemed to be in no great hurry about it, and went on with us for miles. Mela, sitting in the saddle, looking increasingly blissful, while he led the horse. When I asked about the river, we talked at cross purposes for quite a while, he insisting that it was to the east, not the north. Finally, he said, "Oh, you're talking of the Sally River. I only know the name of it. It's a long, long way. It's the edge of the world. Our Ambare flows to it, I guess, but I don't know how far. You'll be walking a long time. Better get horses." "If we go east, we'll come to your river?" "Yes, but it's a good long ways, too." He gave us complicated directions involving drovers' paths and cart roads, and then ended up saying, "Of course, if you just cut across those hills ahead of us, you'll be at the Ambare in no time." "Well, maybe we'll head that way," I said. And he said,
I might as well go that way too. Those cattle might be over there.
That made me suspicious of him. So fear taints the mind. I walked along wondering if he had been watching for us, if he was leading us to a trap, and how to get rid of him. And at the same time, certain that he was simply a lonely man, happy to have company and pleased to please a child. As I grew silent, he talked with Mele, who timidly asked him questions about the horse and its gear. Soon he was giving her a riding lesson, letting her hold the rein, telling her how to put Brownie into a trot. He was soft-voiced and easygoing with both the horse and the child. When he put out his hand to show her how to hold the rein, she pulled away from him in fear, and after that, he never came very close to her, treating her with an innate tact. It was hard to distrust him. But I strode on, weighed down with suspicion and worry. If it was so far to the Sansali that this man thought it the end of the world, and if with Mele I could not walk more than 10 miles a day, how long would it take us to get there? I felt that as we crept across these open plains we were exposed, visible to anybody looking for us. Our companion's guidance so far was true. Having crossed the low range of hills, we saw a good-sized river a couple of miles farther on, flowing northeast. We stopped just over the crest of the hills and sat down under a stand of great beeches to share our food, while Brownie had a bait of oats from a nose bag. Mele called our companion Cowboy D, which made him grin. He called her Sunny. She sat beside me, but talked to him. They talked at great length about horses and cattle. I noticed that she kept asking him questions, as children will do, out of real curiosity, no doubt. But also it meant that she didn't have to answer any questions about herself or me. She was canny. We could see a boat or barge now and then on the river, and our companion said, "There you are. Going along to town and get yourselves onto a boat, and that'll take you far as you want, eh?" "Where's town?" Mele asked. "On down along there," he said, waving vaguely at the river where it disappeared in a long bend among low hills. "I guess I better not go with you. I don't think any of our cattle got any farther than this, but you go on down to town and get yourselves onto a boat, and that'll take you as far as you want, eh?" I thought it strange that he said it again, exactly the same way, as if he'd memorized it, as if he'd been taught how to lead us into a trap. "That's a good idea," Mele said. "Isn't it, Avi?"
"Could be," I said.
She had a quite emotional parting from the horse, patting and petting it and embracing its long, mild head, and she and the cowboy said goodbye affectionately, though without touching. She watched him ride off over the crest of the hills and sighed as we started down. "They were beautiful," she said. I felt ashamed of myself, but still couldn't relax from my wariness. "Will we find the town and get on a boat?"
"I don't think so."
"Why not?"
I found I couldn't express my reasons. "We must go on. We must escape the man who was following us." But no way of travel seemed safe to me.
"Or we could get horses, like he said. Only, are horses very expensive?"
"I think they are. And you have to know how to ride them."
"I do now. Sort of."
"I don't," I said shortly.
We walked on. It was easy going, downhill, and Mele flitted right along. At the bottom of the hill, a dim footpath led off toward the river, and we followed that.
"So it would be better to get on a boat," Mele said.
"Wouldn't it?"
I felt my sense of responsibility for her like a stone on my back, weighing me down.
If it was just myself, I'd run, I'd hide, I'd be gone, long gone. I was angry with her for holding me back, slowing my steps, arguing with me about how to go. "I don't know," I said. We went on, I always aware of shortening my pace to hers. We were now on a cart track, coming nearer the river, and saw the roofs of a small town ahead to the right, and soon the wharves and boats tied up. I'd asked the Lord Luck to give this child the blessing he'd given me. Was I to distrust him, too? Only a fool acts as if he knows better than luck. I'd always been a fool, but not that kind. "We'll see when we get there," I said, after a half mile of silence.
"We can pay for it, can't we?"
I nodded. So when we came through apple orchards into town, we went straight down to the riverfront and looked about. No boats were tied up, and nobody was on the dock. There was a small inn just up the street, its door standing open, and I looked in. A dwarf, a man no taller than Mele, with a big head and a handsome, scowling face, looked round the bar.
"What'll you have, Marshy?"
he said. I all but turned and ran.
"What's that with you, a pup?"
"No, by Sampa, a kid. Both of you kids.
What do you want, then, milk?"
"Yes," I said, and Mele said, "Yes, please." He fetched 2 cups of milk, and we sat at a small table to drink it. He stood by the bar and looked us over. His gaze made me very uneasy, but Mele didn't seem to mind it, and gazed right back at him without her usual shyness.
"Is there a black cat?" she asked.
"Why would there be?"
"It said on the sign over the door. The picture."
"Ah, no. That's the house. Sign of the black cat. Blessing of Enu, it is. Where are you bound, then? On your own, are you?"
"Down river," I said.
"You're off a boat, then?"
He looked out the open door to see if any boat had docked. "No, walking. Thought we might go by water if there's a boat would take us."
"Nothing in now. Pedri's barge will be in tomorrow."
"Going downstream?"
"Clear to the Sally," the man said.
So it seemed they called the Sensali in this country. He refilled Mela's cup, then stumped to the bar and came back with 2 full mugs of cider. He set one down in front of me and raised the other in salute. I drank with him. Mele raised her cup of milk, too.
"Stay tonight, if you like," he said.
Mele looked at me, bright-eyed. It was coming on to evening. I did my best to forget my fears and take what luck gave us. I nodded.
"Anything to pay with?"
he asked. I took a couple of bronzes from my pocket.
"Because if you hadn't, I'd eat the kid, see?"
the dwarf said in a matter-of-fact tone, and lunged with a hideous, gaping, threatening face at Mele. She shrank back against me with a great gasp, but then she laughed, sooner than I could smile at his joke. He drew back, grinning.
"I was scared," she said to him.
He looked pleased. I could feel her heart beating, shaking her small body.
"Put it away," he said to me. "We'll settle up when you go."
He sent us upstairs to a little room at the front of the house. It looked out through low windows over the river and was clean enough, though full of beds, 5 of them crammed in it side by side. He cooked us a good supper, which we ate along with a couple of longshoremen who ate there every night. They didn't talk, and the host said little. Mele and I walked around the wharves for a while after supper to see the evening light on the water, and then went up to bed. At first, I couldn't get to sleep, my mind racing and racing among fruitless thoughts and fears. At last, I dropped into sleep, but never very deeply, And then I sat up, blindly reaching for my knife, which I'd set on the floor beside my cot. Steps on the staircase, stopping and starting. The door creaked. A man came into the room. I could just make out his bulk in the faint starlight from the windows. I sat still, holding my breath and my knife. The big dark shape blundered past my bed, felt its way over to the end bed, and sat down. I heard shoes thump on the floor. The man lay down, thrashed about a bit, muttered a curse, and lay still. Pretty soon he began to snore. I thought it was a ruse. He wanted us to think he was asleep. But he kept it up, deep and long, till daybreak. When Mella woke and found a strange man in the room, she was very frightened. She couldn't wait to get out. Our host gave her warm milk for breakfast, and me warm cider, along with good bread and fresh peaches. I was too restless and uneasy to want to wait for the barge. I told him we'd be going on foot. He said,
"If you want to walk, walk. But if you want to float, she'll be along in an hour or two."
And Mella nodded. So I obeyed. The barge came into the wharf in the middle of the morning, a long, heavy craft with a kind of house amidships that made me think of Almeida's boat in the marshes. The decks were piled with crates, hay bales, several cages of chickens, all kinds of goods and parcels. While unloading and loading went on, I asked the master if we could take passage, and we settled soon enough on a silver piece for fare, all the way to the Sensali, sleeping on deck. I went back to the Black Cat to settle our bill there.
"A bronze," the dwarf said.
"Two beds, food and drink," I protested, putting down four bronzes. He pushed two back to me.
"I don't often get a guest my own size," he said, unsmiling.
So we left that town, went aboard Pedri's barge, and set off down the river Ambara at about noon. The sun was bright, the bustle of the docks cheerful, and Mella was excited to be on board a ship, though she kept at a distance from the master and his assistant, and always very close to me. I felt relieved to be on the water. I said in my mind the prayer to the Lord of the Springs and Rivers I'd learned from my uncle in Ferusi. I stood with Mille, watching the longshoremen free the rope and the master haul it in while the gap of roiling water slowly widened between the boat and the dock. Just as the barge began to turn to take the current, a man came down the street and out onto the docks. It was Hobie. We were in plain sight, standing against the wall of the boathouse. I dropped down to sit on the deck, hiding my face in my arms. "What's wrong?" Mella asked, squatting down beside me. I dared a glance over my forearm. Hobie stood on the dock, looking after the barge. I couldn't tell if he had seen me.
"Beaky, what's wrong?"
the child whispered. I finally answered, "Bad luck."